Do not attempt to change the channel.
All media are extensions of some human faculty.
Is books part of the media?
Media, we don't need it, do we?
Baby, this thing is bigger than all of us.
The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word.
Media is any form of communication. It can be radio, television, computers.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
You know, we live in the most mediated society in world history. You spend 10 to 12 hours a day with media. And so I think it makes sense to think about, in a sort of systematic and sustained way, our relationship with media.
Hello. Hello, folks, and welcome to Be the Media. You're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM here in Nanaimo. And, of course, on this show, Be the Media, we talk about all things media, from the local to the global, and we include perspectives of consumers and producers. All of our contributors here on the show are faculty, students, and friends of the Media Studies Department and the Media Research Lab at Vancouver Island University. I'm Marion Vanderzon, and today I'm joined live in the studio here with Neil Scobie and Joy Googler and our first guest up, Helen Brown. So I'd like to give you an overview of the show, what we have going on today. We're going to start the show with a live interview with Helen Brown. Helen Brown is going to be giving us an overview of the Arts and Humanities Colloquium. And this has been going on for quite a few years at the university, but it's really expanded in the last couple of years. And throughout this spring, there are three talks, one in February, one in March, one in April, and all three talks directly link to media. So we'll start with Helen to give us an overview of the colloquium, and then I want to focus on the talk that happens next week, next Friday, in fact, with Dr. Keith Smith. He's from the Department of First Nations Studies and the Department of History, and his subject is On Blackhawks, Pontiacs, and Crazy Horse Malt Liquor, the Policy and Cultural Relations Implications of Constructed Images. So what I'd like to do is follow up the overview with a monologue by Celinda Rice. And she's going to provide us with a foray into the first speaker in the colloquium, Dr. Keith Smith. After that, we're going to shift gears and we're going to move into a special segment of Books and Bites. And this will be an interview with Sarah Iwanishan about fan fiction. And Joy Googler, of course, will be interviewing her. We'll continue the show today with Paparazzi Trigger Finger by Kevin Mazutenek and the next installment of Robin Davies' Further Excerpts from The Oral Machine. I'd like to really encourage you to contact us here at Be the Media with any feedback you have or story ideas. You can contact us by email at bethemedia@viu.ca. Again, it's bethemedia@viu.ca. You're also welcome to phone in during the show, and the number here, 250-740-1017. We'd love to hear from you. The show is also podcast, and to hear the podcast, you simply go to chly.ca. You'll see the podcast link, and you can find us, Be the Media, in the list. You can also find all our past shows, and there are some really excellent, interesting shows, so we encourage you to do that. Let's jump in. I'd like to start by welcoming Helen Brown to the studio. I'm going to just give you a little bit of background on Helen Brown. Helen Brown has been teaching at Vancouver Island University, which was, of course, formerly Malaspina University College, since 1970. She's taught there for 38 years in the history department. She's now retired, and one of her passions is very much the love of ideas. And this perhaps is why she's so directly involved in the Arts and Humanities Colloquium. So, Helen, welcome.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me to talk about the colloquium.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Maybe we could start by having you tell us what the colloquium is, how it started, just a little bit of background, a little bit of an overview.
It started several years ago in the English department. About six times a year, somebody would do a presentation and everyone was invited. I went to quite a few of them, and what I found amazing was how the work of people in the English department was connected to work that I was doing. So a year ago, the Arts and Humanities Department decided to take the colloquium and make it something that would involve faculty from across arts and humanities. And a lot of people don't know exactly what we're talking about when we talk about arts and humanities. But it's an administrative component, if you will, of Vancouver Island University. And it encompasses a number of disciplines. History, for example, where I taught, English, obviously where it started, but media studies, where you are, Marion, theater, languages. It's a very broad grouping of disciplines. And so the colloquium lets people in one discipline speak to people in another discipline and also speak to the public at large. And so this is the third semester that we have run the broader Arts and Humanities Colloquium series. A lot of people, just as arts and humanities can be a puzzling term to those who aren't around the campus a lot, so can the word colloquium, but it's just a conversation. It's a conversation on a specific topic. And this spring, we have three topics. And I don't know, would you like me to talk about them now?
Yeah, the reason why I wanted to have you in on the show is because this spring, all three topics directly connect to media. And for us, of course, that's very exciting. So, yes, maybe you could let us know what all three talks are and when they are as well, provide the dates and whatnot.
I chuckled, actually, when I got your email noting that all three of these talks relate to the media, because when I looked at the three, I thought, oh, this is really interesting. All three of these talks are historical, deal with historical issues. And I think, actually, right there is the key to the colloquium. Whatever you are interested in, astonishingly, these presentations link to it. So for people who have specific interests, or for people who just enjoy thinking about ideas, the colloquium has proved to be a huge success. And one other thing I'll just mention before I talk about each one specifically is the fact that we're very proud of the fact that we serve refreshments. So we start at 10 in the morning. It's always on a Friday morning. And when you come to, it's usually on the fifth floor of the library in the boardroom. The refreshments are already there. So people can come in, have a cup of coffee, have something to eat. There's an information table with a lot of information about different projects around the community, different events that are hosted through the Arts and Humanities Department. It's a very, very friendly atmosphere, and there's no charge.
And I'd like to make it really clear that it's absolutely open to community members. So anyone in the community who's listening today, do feel free to join us at these colloquium sessions. And I'll also mention that when you go to the library to the fifth floor, there's also a spectacular view.
The view up there is stunning. It's one of the places on the campus where they've really been able to maximize the view. Yes, open to the public, certainly. And what has happened over the the last year, we've been able to connect to a lot of groups in the public and the people in them, whether it's the poetry groups, literature groups, book reading clubs, and we're starting to get people coming to every colloquium. So they come because something interests them, and then they keep coming back. So we're getting a really good broad audience from the community.
What are some of the topics?
This semester, the first one, they're all the first Fridays of the month. So the first one's February the 4th. Keith Smith from the First Nations Studies Department and the History Department is talking about something that I think will have resonance with a lot of people. He's talking about the fact that there are clearly problems with policies that have been developed by the federal government, by provincial governments, dealing with First Nations people. We can't look at their situation in Canada and say this has been a huge success. In fact, most people are frustrated by the lack of success, although there obviously are huge strides and advances. So what Keith is tackling is something that's really problematic. What underlies this? Why are we having repeated situations when we want to change it? And he thinks it's because of the images of First Nations people that have been constructed. He looks at it historically, goes back to the late 19th century, and then comes right up to the present. So his talk on Blackhawks, Pontiacs, and Crazy Horse Malt Liquor all deal with images that have been created. And because the images are wrong, the policies that flow from them are always problematic. Mm-hmm. The second presentation in the series is March 4th. This is a really interesting, again, very different from Keith's, but also dealing with history. In this case, the history of Nanaimo and the coal mining working class union history here. The presentation by Ross Dupre is linked to the production of We Two, a play that Ross is directing. The opening night of the play is March 3rd, and March 4th on the Friday is when he's doing the presentation. It's going to be in the theater. All the sets will be there. And he's going to be talking about a different kind of historical problem. How do you translate what happened in the past onto a stage? There's all sorts of limitations. There's all sorts of considerations from the political to the technical. And Ross has done a lot of work acting in and directing plays that have a historical framework, like 10 Lost Years, which a lot of people will remember. And so he really lets us sit in front of the set, but he takes us behind the scenes in the production of historical theater. And why does that matter? Because so much theater in Canada has been historical since about the 1970s. And he's going to explain why it became a major form of theater starting in the 70s.
Sounds great. And that play also runs then to March 12th.
March 3rd to 12th, that's right. So for those who go opening night, you might want to come on the 4th and see a whole different perspective of the play. And for those who don't know if they want to go to the play, this is a chance to come into the theater, no charge, and get a look at what's involved in producing that play.
Fabulous.
The third production is April the 1st, and we're back up in the library boardroom as we were with Keith to start with. Marnie Stanley from the Women's Studies Department is talking about something that she's very interested in and extremely knowledgeable about, and that is graphic stories. She's going to be talking specifically about comics, looking at the women who've worked in writing comics, and the way that gender has played out in the production of the whole world of comics. She has a break point to the 1960s, which was a major decade of women's activity, opened the door for a lot of women to become involved in the graphic comic arena.
Great. They all sound fabulous. I'd like to take this moment and also extend thanks to both you, Helen Brown, and also Katerina Rout, because you two are the two organizers of the Arts and Humanities Colloquium, and certainly there's extensive work behind it in order to make it happen and keep it going all this time.
Yes, it's true. There is a lot of work, and Katerina has just been an amazing person to work with because she works so hard. It's a challenge to keep up with her.
Helen, thank you very much for giving an overview of the Arts and Humanities Colloquium. What I'd like to do is I'd like to jump back and focus on Dr. Keith Smith's piece. He will be at the colloquium in, well, a week from tomorrow, so February 4th. And again, it's the fifth floor of the library, building 305, room 507, and it happens 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m., and it sounds like a fabulous talk. One of our students, a digital media studies student, Celinda Rice, has put together a monologue that really gets into some of the issues that Dr. Smith is speaking about, beyond what you've already mentioned, Helen, and I'd like to move into that at this point. So thank you for joining us. This next track we have up is called Hidden Blues, and we'll follow that up with Celinda Rice.
Good afternoon. My name is CJ Rice. I'm from the Snanimo First Nations, and I'm studying digital media at Vancouver Island University. You've probably heard me on other shows here at CHLY, and today I was asking the questions. We'll be finding out about the upcoming Arts and Humanities Colloquium Spring 2011 series, starting February 4th from 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Friday morning at the fifth floor boardroom of the library at VIU, building 305, room 507. The initial discussion is called On Blackhawks, Pontiacs, and Crazy Horse Malt Liquor, the Policy and Cultural Relations Implications of Constructed Images. I spoke with Dr. Keith Smith earlier from the First Nations Studies Department at Vancouver Island University here in Nanaimo. He's received his PhD from the University of Calgary, and he completed a Master of Arts History at University of Victoria, and he completed his Bachelor of Arts with Honors also at University of Victoria. Dr. Smith has special interests in the historical relations between Indigenous peoples and settler societies, and also the relations between imperial powers and colonized peoples on a global scale. Dr. Smith, or Keith, I first asked him, what is a colloquium? And he let me know that it's a discussion between people about certain subjects that have been researched, just so that we can share and find out more about that particular subject. And in this case, it's open to the public. Everyone is free to come. There will be food served afterwards, so he's inviting you to come and check it out. see what it's all about. Maybe you're interested in First Nations history. Maybe you're interested in history. Maybe you just want to come and get to know some of the people here to see whether or not this is a place that you want to learn. This is one way to do it. I asked Dr. Smith how he got interested in First Nations studies in the first place, and he said it was through his undergraduate studies. He had to take a quantitative methods course, and in that course, he was given information from Indian and Northern Affairs. They have piles and piles of statistics to go through, and in going through them, he realized just how inappropriate they were. The studies, he didn't understand why they were taking them. Like, why would anybody want to know how many carrots were being taken out of the ground in Nanaimo, or how much wheat was being grown in the Cowichan Valley? And he actually, that was one of the interesting statistics, he said, because the Cowichan Valley had more wheat at the turn of the century being grown than in the prairies for First Nations, by First Nations. But he said some of the other things weren't interesting at all, like how many people were wearing civilized clothing, didn't understand where they were coming from, what the perspective was, why they wanted to know that kind of information, and realized that it was coming from the perspective of someone who had a paternalistic attitude towards First Nations and, you know, wanted to civilize them and bring them into the non-native society, assimilate them. And this was one way to, you know, say, yes, this is, you know, we've got them growing more carrots this year, or more of them are wearing civilized clothing this year than last year. And he said it was all rather arbitrary, because in one case he read about how this one community was all Catholic one year, and then the next year they were all Protestant. So obviously they, you know, they had gotten a new pastor in, or a new person in charge who decided that's what they were going to do. And it just led him into this whole study, this whole field of study about communications between the two cultures, and how in this particular case there are offensive logos being used for sporting events like the Blackhawks, and how it can be taken to another level, perhaps. In looking at that picture, it can be compared to the pictures that we use to associate the Germans with the Jews during the World War II. It can be viewed as hate crime, perpetuating hate crimes, rather than just being offensive. And there can be legal issues coming from this. Say the Crazy Horse Malt Liquor, through his studies in history, he's realized that Crazy Horse was actually against liquor, and he lobbied to get it out of his reservation. He didn't want anybody to be using it. So to have his picture as their logo was just completely out of context, and not only just offensive, but perpetuating hate crimes, because they're creating the stereotype. They're perpetuating the stereotype. I know, you know, we all do it in one way or another, but should we not just start from a good perspective, start fresh, rather than accepting what is out there? We should actually source it and go, where does this come from, before we use something like that. You know, did they even consider who Crazy Horse was before they put that logo on their malt liquor? And are they open to change when somebody says, hey, I find this offensive? There are groups out there who will change their whole strategy, change their whole logo, change everything, because they find out that it's an offensive thing that they're doing. And then there are groups out there who say, well, no, you know, we've been using this forever, and now you decide that it's offensive? We, you know, we've got it on all our logos, we've got it on all our t-shirts, it's a part of who we are, it's become meaningful to us, it's part of our culture, but when you break it right down to the very basics, it's actually about the money. It has nothing to do with the validating who they are. It's just, well, we can't change it now. Which one are you going to be on? Are you going to be on the one who says, oh, I'm sorry, you know, we're not going to do that anymore? Or are you going to be the one who says, whatever, you know, it costs too much money to change that? So it's something that you can look at how are you perpetuating the stereotype, or how are your friends perpetuating the stereotype, and there can be more discussions opened because of this. It's an important communication vehicle. If you're having trouble, like I've had trouble with this myself, what's a comparable offensive idea? And that would be, you know, the using the priest and his cross and handing out wafers at a hockey game. That would be offensive to a lot of people that actually would be perpetuating hate crime. So I asked Dr. Smith what he hoped would come from this colloquium or this discussion, and what he hoped that people would take away from this. And he said, well, you know, I know I can't change the world, but perhaps I can make a difference in how people start thinking, you know, where they start thinking from. And maybe they'll start checking their sources, and maybe they'll stop perpetuating the stereotypes. You know, there's all we can do is try, right? And this is one good way of doing that. And hopefully you'll come to the colloquium on February 4th and find out more details and data, and there'll be a slideshow, and it's free for everybody. So please come and find out more. So stay tuned. This has been CJ Rice for CHLY 101.7, and we are Being the Media. Thank you.
We're in the studio today for Books and Bites, a special edition with our guest star, Sarah Iwanishin. She is a third-year digital media major at VIU, and she's also been a high school teacher in the Nanaimo area for about 5 years. Before that, she had a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Education at UBC, and she's here with us today to talk about her daughter, Madeline, who is an avid reader and writer of fan fiction, and in particular, Harry Potter and the Star Wars series. She has a somewhat literary obsession, perhaps one might say, with both of those series, and she writes her own fan fiction. For our listeners, Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about what fan fiction is and how you've seen that play out in your own home?
Madeline started writing when she was 11 years old, and writing fan fiction. And I wasn't, at that time, I wasn't aware of what it was. I just knew that she was typing and writing online. And last year I learned a bit about fan fiction in a media course and realized, made the connection. And then when I began looking, I thought it was a bit superficial and started looking into it. And that's when I learned that she was writing quite a bit. And I discovered that her Star Wars chapter or section was 16 chapters long, 30,000 words, and I started taking it a little bit more seriously than just having fun. Fan fiction involves, you have to be a fan. You have to clearly be a huge fan because it involves, you're investing so much time, and clearly she loves it. You can see it in her work. I myself am not a fan, but I can identify with her what you call an obsession. Madeline started reading Harry Potter when she was 7 or 8 years old and has developed, it's true, an obsession for it in every way. And it doesn't surprise me that she wanted to explore it from a creative perspective from herself. It did surprise me that she was writing for Star Wars. Star Wars came from her younger brother. And she told me later that she tends to write for Star Wars more than Harry Potter because there's less competition. So fan fiction is involved. What's involved is going online. She uses fanfiction.com. She has a profile. She writes whenever she wants, whatever she chooses to write on. And she regularly gets reviews, and she reviews other people's work.
How does she absorb that feedback from her contemporaries, and how does it affect her work?
In this culture, there is a lot of give and take. So it's sort of a given that if she gets feedback, she will then go to someone else's or the same person's work and give feedback. Generally, it's positive, but a lot of the time, people are asking her to build on it. I want to know more about this character. What happens next? What a great idea. What's going to happen? When's your next chapter coming out? I see that a lot. And she's writing, well, I can't get on my computer and my mom's on it, you know, hopefully in the next week. She feels really good when she gets feedback. She logs on, she sees it, she gets excited. And I actually asked her one day, these are people you don't even know. How could you care what they think? And she explained those people are there because they're interested in the same topic that she's interested in. Therefore, they automatically have something in common. If she tried to share that, her writing, with her friends who maybe are not interested at all in Star Wars or Harry Potter, she wouldn't get any worthwhile feedback. So she's extremely gracious of the whole exchange.
And reading and writing also both seem to fall down both genre and gender lines. Often you hear that, you know, boys don't read and they don't like to write, and it's somehow seen as something outside of the masculine, whereas girls are more likely to read and are more likely to write and somehow more acceptable. But with fan fiction, particularly in Star Wars, you're seeing a reversal of that. There are a lot of boys in particular who are writing fan fiction that is, I guess, in the science fiction genre. But Madeline is there as a key player as well. Does she feel comfortable in that gender mix? Does she even think about being a woman writing in an area that maybe has been owned, quote unquote, by boys in the past?
I don't think so. I think it's completely different than when I was young. I agree. Madeline, like I said, was introduced through Star Wars through her younger brother, who discovered it through Wii, then started watching all the old movies, which I happily watched with them. And next thing you know, Madeline was hooked. Now, her real hook is on The Phantom Menace, which is a later movie. And that's what she focuses on in her writing, which I find quite interesting that she's found something to absolutely focus on, not just write generic material about Star Wars. So by doing that, she becomes more and more specific, kind of enhances the creativity or the quality of her writing. It would be much easier just to write kind of generic responses to the Star Wars series, which is so huge. I've never heard her once be confused or suggest that perhaps this is an area she should be writing about, that it's a boy's area. I don't see that at all.
That's wonderful. A lot of the authors of the original books, J.K. Rowling and I guess George Lucas in the case of Star Wars, have tended to look at various times in the fan fiction community as something that's derivative. While they appreciate the fans, they're not always appreciative of the work that comes out of it, as if it were, you know, on a totally different level than their own writing, which most people can acknowledge, published and unpublished, though it's published online. Yet it seems unfair, certainly in light of everything you've said, to dismiss it when it is such a hotbed of creative ideas and it is so motivational to young readers and writers. What would you say in defense of fan fiction, or what would Madeline say?
Well, I would say that it is typical of an older generation to not warm up so quickly to new ideas. And in the world of academia and writing, people can be quite closed-minded. Madeline's generation is different. This is taking place online. The whole social aspect of it is completely different. When I was young, I would write at home. Maybe nobody would see it unless I typed it out and took it to somebody. She can have feedback within an hour or two. I asked her specifically that question. Do you think that your writing is not as creative or doesn't involve as much of your imagination as if you'd written right from the beginning? And she argued that, and I think it was a fair argument, that anything a 14-year-old would write would have to be influenced at some point by something. It's not possible. And maybe that applies to everybody. But she's looking at it from a 14-year-old. So any of my peers, she says, Mom, that write anything has to be the result of influence of something along the line, whether it's, because she sees it. She sees a style of writing that's been adopted. She doesn't necessarily adopt a style. She has her own style. She creates characters. She creates subplots, action. I mean, this is yes, those things are already in place, as in the story. People are familiar with it. She doesn't have to reinvent all that. But where would her audience be if she didn't have fan fiction, too? If she just wrote on her own, which she does, too, where would she put that? And would there be an audience? Where would she get that feedback? Here she already automatically has an audience.
Traditionally, we think of writers finding their own voice in writers' retreats and workshops and in creative writing schools like the one at VIU and in contests and other sort of book clubs or writing clubs where they get together. This is essentially incorporating all those same mentorship abilities as well as that peer community instantly and online and internationally, and it's quite incredible that such a thing exists, and I agree that it's changed many minds once you investigate it further. Your own research has obviously revealed a number of layers of this activity. Do you feel like you have come round to it, to see it in a different way, or to see it, why Madeline is so attracted to it?
I definitely have. Now, I have to admit, I would not participate in it. Doesn't feel natural to me, but I grew up at a different time. Certainly see much more value in it than I did before. I used to think that even fantasy writing had no value in it, so I've come a long way in realizing that she's not living a fantasy life. She's still expressing herself, her feelings, her perspective with a community of people that care.
Do you think she'll go on to find her own material outside of Harry Potter and Star Wars in the near future? You said she's writing some of her own original work as well, and no doubt employing some of the techniques that she's learned in this community. Does she have aspirations to be a published writer?
That is her plan. So in her career education, she's one of the few students her age who actually has a goal, has taken all the tests that show that, yes, that's where she's leading. So she's always said that since she was little, she's going to be an author. As far as I've tried to suggest that, hey, maybe a creative writing club at school is necessary or a workshop, and her immediate response is, oh, no, then I'd have to share it. So there's definitely, she's still a teenager. She still doesn't necessarily want to open up that way. She feels safe with the anonymous reviews she gets.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in college or towards college, she'll be more confident in sharing her writing.
Well, it sounds like it's an evolution that you can go from an anonymous environment where you can put the material out there but don't have to be in the same room with them where they're giving you feedback, or you don't have to read your work out loud to people as you would in a bookstore environment or in a classroom environment. But she may, through this kind of rehearsal of those skills, find herself more comfortable with that in the future.
I think most teenagers are a little bit insecure in getting assessment of any of their work. She probably would be more comfortable in sharing her work with teachers than her own peers, looking for their insight rather than just I like it or I don't like it. But I asked her, would you share this with any of your teachers? And she didn't think any of them would be interested. Although she did say the librarian would be. The librarian is very interested in all the books, right? And up on.
Well, to the teachers and librarians and parents who might be listening, we would certainly encourage them through this example to consider taking fan fiction more seriously, if for nothing else, the fact that they are reading and writing voraciously and acquiring those skills. And, of course, in, you know, exploring their own imaginations. It's hard to argue with that motherhood project. It's really wonderful to see it. Any final thoughts on the world of fan fiction? Is it business as usual at the computer these days with Madeline? Is she writing away?
Madeline is more excited than anything, than ever. She, like I said, she goes online. As soon as she sees any feedback, she immediately wants to start writing the next chapter. So the feedback is motivational. If there was no feedback, I don't see it continuing. Madeline likes to read historical fiction. She's not just centered on fantasy. But the fantasy seems to give room for the creative writing. I hope that she continues to do her own writing. But now that I know a lot more about fan fiction, I'm certainly not as critical. I no longer see it as superficial. I see the value in it. And I see that her writing at school has improved when she's given that opportunity.
Well, it used to be a fantasy to be published at 14. And now we're seeing that through blogs and through these kinds of sites, fanfiction.com and others. So it's evolution of one sort or another. Thank you so much, Sarah, for coming into the studio and sharing your story.
Thank you, Joy, for having me.
Michael Rennie was ill the day the earth stood still, but he told us where we stand. And Flash Gordon was there in silver underwear. Claude Rains was the invisible man. Then something went wrong for Fay Wray and King Kong. They got caught.
Welcome back to Be the Media. Next up, we have Kevin Mazurtenik with Paparazzi Trigger Finger. You're listening to Be the Media here on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo.
Well, let's see what caliber of truths I can deliver today. I'm Kevin Mazurtenik, and welcome to Paparazzi Trigger Finger. At the sound of the turning page, we will begin a new fiction. The Blue Motion Store, page 7. Possible to tell if it was intentional or if there was serious damage to the outside. Did you strain it properly? Of course. Don't you trust me? That question hit the floor like a bad, bad penny. You wouldn't hardly miss it, yet, at the same time, it would rotate and ring out as if struck and stung stupid with the flick of a forefinger, ringing and spinning, spinning and ringing, the rotations creating an illusion of a sphere of so little substance that it could barely cast a shadow. 9 out of 10 times, then with a slight backpedal. Actually, maybe 8. Yeah, I would trust you 8 out of 10 times. 8, hey? Well, let's see what caliber of truths I can deliver today. The syringe, guided delicately by the expert hands of our heroine, set up to slurp as she began to salivate over the next words spoken. Now, it'll be interesting to see just what they've been saying behind my back. That fucking Antoine. He had a good heart, the best of intentions, the same old, same old. But his vanity kept bonking him up against the ceiling like an overpriced helium balloon donkey hat feebly fabricated by some meth-head carny clown. And where is the eyesore Eeyore now? It stands upside down on all fours at the top of the tent, surrounded by dozens of other balloons intentionally let loose by children who, without a word, physically challenged the advice of parents and guardians to hold tight and hang on to the goddamn things. Inevitably, a fleet of these pilotless airships would rise like a symphony of inverted tears, accumulating into an aerial pool to be consumed by just such a jackass, c'est la vie. You feel that you've been the topic of much discussion lately. Doris always did her best to put her customers at ease. I do. Well, my dear, exactly how much ammo did you provide them with? Ersatz Sublime, page 40. Ace, nudge. That's one ugly word. Nudge. Okay, 2 ugly words. There they lay, belly and breast to the cool floor, propped up on elbows with chins resting in the open palms of their hands, and holding, quietly watching for the primal orange glow of the electric heater to crackle to life and burn off the accumulated dust boulders, firing them into the air like a volcano snorting to life in the middle of the night during a restless rollover between cool bed sheets of plate tectonic proportion. Darren breaks the trance. This is exactly the kind of thing I miss. I miss you 1AU, Kyla interrupts. Know what that means? 1AU? Astronomical unit. The distance between the Earth and the sun. To express the enormity of this gelid gap, she lifts her head from her hands and holds them palm facing palm, shoulder width apart. AU. Isn't that a great measurement? Could have picked a better name, though. Yeah, astronomical unit is a little cold. You could sing it. Pardon? You could sing it, like, I miss you, 1AU. The limitations of Kyla's poker face are hyperextended in a desperate attempt to keep her innards inward and laughter from lining up to take its best shot at spreading them out on the floor. Forgive me, but that actually borders... No, that's clinging for dear life to the roots at the very edge of pathetic. And bless her heart for at least trying. You do realize that, right? Shouldn't this thing be turning orange, asks Darren. The heater? Yeah, shouldn't it be glowing like the sun by now? Maybe they've improved it. Probably. I give it another 5. I'm enjoying the suspense. As it turns out, Albuquerque, New Mexico, as opposed to Alfonso D., Portuguese conqueror of Goa, saw one of the most tragic and heart-wrenching catastrophes ever linked to.
Thank you for tuning in, and once again, this is Kevin Mazatenik from Paparazzi Triggerfinger.
And hello, you're listening to Be the Media on CHLY 101.7 FM. Many thanks to all the contributors on the show today: Helen Brown, Kevin Mazutenik, Sarah Iwanishan, Joy Googler, Neil Scobie. I'm Marianne Vanderzon. We're going to leave you with Robin Davies, further excerpts from The Oral Machine.
You are listening to
further excerpts from The Oral Machine.
Every patient is wide choices. In other patients, for a block of space time constituted by the periodic repetition of the
And this is interesting because she's an awful lot of early electronic music to see how that really stemmed from radio focus. So there was a beautiful lot of really interesting sound design happening in radio plays. And there's a very interesting crossover in the early 50s of these sorts of territories, and this features kind of music and sound. You can call it sound effects, but it really it's music.
And why am I fighting other vampires?
I must be a noble vampire, a good guy on a mission of redemption. I help the helpless. I'm a vampire with a soul.
You are listening to Be The Medium on CHLY 101.7 FM.
A child in the dark, gripped with fear, comforts herself by singing under her breath. She walks enthralled to her song. Lost, she takes shelter, orients herself with her little song as best she can. The song is like a rough sketch of a calming and stabilizing, calm and stable, centering the heart of chaos. Perhaps the child skips as she sings, hastens or slows her pace. But the song itself is already a skip. It jumps from chaos to the beginnings of order in chaos and is in danger of breaking apart at any moment. Radios and television sets are like sound walls around every household and mark territories. For sublime deeds like the foundation of a city, one draws a circle, or better yet, walks in a circle, as in a children's dance, combining rhythmic vowels and consonants that correspond to the interior forces of creation as to the differentiated parts of an organism. A mistake in speed, rhythm, or harmony would be catastrophic because it would bring back the forces of chaos, destroying both creator and creation.
Be the Media is brought to you by the Media Studies Department and the Media Research Lab at VIU.
How does that grab you?